thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
Sunshine.
Here's John Williams.
Here's a big thought for you. What's your bright side? We'll ask you to do that towards the end of the show. We're just rolling. Hi, it's John in the Allstate Skyline Studio. We're here weekdays from 1 to 3, and we'll do a little show for you tomorrow between 10 a.m. and 12 noon. I think you'll like that one, too. It's the John Williams Show. It's Friday. So we sent Jay, our intern, to the Humble Park Lagoon to see if he could at least report to us what the search is like for Chance the Snapper, the alligator that has shown up in Chicago. Imagine that. We've got an alligator.
Standing next to me right now is Billy Ocasio. He is the director of National Museum of Puerto Rican Arts and Culture, and the museum is actually right next to the lagoon.
Oh, it's very good for us. You know, we got a lot of people coming by, but let me just say, this is just unbelievable.
Hand the phone in the meantime back to Jay, and then
We're going to send Jay out there and make sure he sees this this alligator and gets all the information to you. He's doing a great job.
Mike, you're on WGN Radio.
Back in the 60s, I grew up in the Humble Park area, and I caught two alligators, one 3 foot and one over 5 foot. Plus, I caught six piranhas. At first, I thought they were big-ass bluegill, but then when I started taking a look out, I seen the teeth, and then that's when I knew they were piranhas.
How do you catch the alligators?
I wrapped my shirt around my hand, the three-footer. It bit me. I flung it to shore, and my cousin stepped on it when it was on its back.
Bob, the alligator hunter, is actually charged with catching the dang thing. Bob, this is John. You're on WGN Radio. How are you?
Just a little tiring with all the commotion going on here. We usually try to keep these type of things quiet so that it doesn't become a media circus like this.
Bob, I want you to know the mayor was asked about you today, and she's feeling great confidence that you're going to get the job done. She said you're up to it, and she feels good about the fact that you're in charge.
We just happen to like reptiles, and because we study them, I've gotten very good at it. We're keeping our fingers crossed.
And keep your fingers. All right, Bob, well, good luck to you.
Just got off work, and I always just listened to your show, and I was like, yeah, I got to call it in. Yes, I think I understand what they're trying to say in the song. That there's a crocodile in the Humboldt Park Lagoon, and that they don't know whether it has papers or not.
Oh, that's good. Thanks for the call.
I'm a big fan of your show. I'm glad I finally called. I texted you many times, like on your show on different topics, but I figured now I'll call it in.
I had the feeling all of Chicago came together around Chance the Snapper, who is still evidently floating somewhere around the Humboldt Park Lagoon. Thanks to Jay, our intern, for being our man on the scene, and to all of you who called in with observations, questions, and comments. Still out there, though. You know, Griff saw this story in the Chicago Tribune by Charles Johnson. I didn't see it, but there it is. Flashback to the spring of 1893. The World's Columbian Exposition had brought a parade of curios to the Chicago lakeshore. Spanish caravels and a Viking longboat, a moving sidewalk. Imagine that in 1893, and the first Ferris wheel, which you know about if you've read Devil in the White City, documented amazingly there, along with people and cultures from around the globe, all turned Jackson Park and the Midway into the World's Museum, and there, making the trip to Chicago from Central Florida, were two alligators named General Davis and Columbus. They had them in a little pond out there, and it was still pretty cool, and the gators were freezing. So they brought the gators inside. But General Davis then developed pneumonia, according to the paper, and passed away after only a few weeks in Chicago's White City. The other one, I guess, lived for the duration of the fair.
We are hearing from Black Club Chicago that there's not been a sighting in 24 hours.
Wonder if that should concern us.
Well, I would think so.
What do you think that means, that he's out of the lagoon or that he's not with us anymore?
I don't know what it would mean, but I just, you know, there were pretty frequent sightings before, and apparently there's not been one for some time.
Well, the alligator hunter sure made it sound yesterday like the alligator does not. He says a lot of people don't like public speaking. They get intimidated and they, you know, shrink up. And this alligator sees us as predators, and all of us standing around are akin to, he said, the alligator being asked to give a speech. So it's hiding. It doesn't want to do this. And So there's where that story is today. If you're over at Humboldt Park, if you see the alligator, of course, give us a call here at Alligator Central. The news click at WGNRadio.com yesterday was about a different subject, something we also discussed on the show yesterday. We asked if the governor should have canceled the Confederate Railroad concert that was supposed to take place at the DuQuoin State Fair. But because the word Confederate appears in the name of the band and also they have a Confederate flag, he doesn't want them there, and he described what he thinks about the Confederate imagery. We asked you if you agree with the governor that he should have canceled the concert, and 93% of you said no. 93% said no, 7% of you said yes. Maybe the news click today should be a little bit about whether or not the Labor Secretary should have stepped down. The president stands behind him today. He said, I want you to know, he said this while former Secretary of Labor, what was his first name again? Labor Secretary Acosta. Yeah. So the president said that if it was up to Donald Trump, if you believe him, because then immediately they say this isn't the truth, but the president was saying if it was up to him, he would still be there. But Alex Acosta is stepping down to do Donald Trump a favor and to sort of eliminate this distraction. But the president says he would still be there. It's an interesting kind of argument if you don't want to just use these people as the examples of it. But if somebody, you know, made a mistake or did a bad job or did something questionable in their old role, but in their new position, they're doing fine. I didn't even know that he was the Secretary of Labor. And I haven't heard anybody say that in the couple of years he's been the Labor Secretary that he's done a terrible job. So you could argue that he could still be Labor Secretary. It's just we really don't like that other stuff. But how does that other stuff, right, compromise his ability to do whatever it is that a Labor Secretary does?
Well, one of the things the Labor Secretary oversees is the fight against human trafficking. And so, I mean, this is in many ways a human trafficking story.
Yeah. And maybe that's a simple way to connect the dots on that.
Well, it's not simple. It's exact and direct.
So he's out, and he is now the 13th former Trump administration cabinet member. I saw this story in the Sun Crimes today, and this has been we'll craft a news click along those lines. But the one that you have been asked to vote on yesterday, and I guess you could still vote on today, has to do with the governor canceling Confederate Railroad's concert at the DuQuoin State Fair. 93%. We don't normally get that kind of a divide. 93% of you said that he should have let him sing. Then there's this question that appeared in the story that was in the Sun Times today, and it's about drag racing downtown Chicago. Have you guys ever been downtown Chicago at 1 or 2 in the morning? Oh, my God. It is unbelievable. I mean, the cars are so loud and would lead you to believe they're going so fast right on Lakeshore Drive. Wham! Like that. So now, if they catch you, it's a $10,000 fine. Minimum is $5,000. And I don't know what took them so long. I mean, for a few months, I lived downtown a couple of years ago. And again, if you've ever stayed with friends or just been in the city, if you've been where I'm standing right now, if you've been in the Loop or the Gold Coast or any of the popular areas down by Navy Pier late at night, it's insane. But we're talking 2 in the morning, so maybe you haven't been there at 2 in the morning. But you just can't believe what you're hearing or imagine what you're seeing. And the reason they're doing it isn't, I don't know, because the roads are so unsafe, although I guess that makes them unsafe, but it's because it's hard to sleep. I mean, you've got the windows closed and you have this thousands and thousands of people trying to sleep. Now, a lot of them are in hotels, so we don't care, but a lot of people live downtown by the lake too, and you just can't get around that noise. So Brendan Riley, 42nd, says the Sun-Times, Fran Spielman's writing. Tried again Thursday to wave the black flag at daredevil motorists who use lower Wacker Drive. Now, she's saying lower Wacker Drive. Yeah, maybe it's lower Wacker Drive, too.
That's where there's been a real problem, I know, underneath.
Well, there was a fatal crash there a few years ago, I know. But it seems to me like what I have been hearing was on Lakeshore Drive. Maybe it's just lower Wacker Drive, which would even be scarier, right? I mean, because you don't have the best sight lines down there for the Fast and Furious style racing and spin contests. He persuaded the City Council Committee on Pedestrian and Traffic Safety to slap daredevil drag racers with fines as high as $10,000. The minimum would be $5,000. Currently, in Chicago, there is no specific fine for drag racing. I got a ticket for drag racing once, and I was doing about 45 miles an hour.
You were drag racing?
In my dad's, what would it have been? It would have been the yellow car. It was like an Oldsmobile. It was not a fast car. And I wasn't really drag racing. But I think Mark Mitchell was driving on the road ahead of me, and I thought I'd pull around and talk to him when we rolled down our windows. We were teenagers. So as the two of us were going by, we were taking up both lanes of traffic. It's what a drag race would look like. But we were doing about 35 or 40 miles an hour. And the police officer, this is how stupid you are sometimes. We go right by a cop. I go, oh. I thought, well, it's okay. I'm not speeding. He pulls me over and he says, I could get you for drag racing. You can't be driving down the road talking to your friend out the window there. I said, yeah, I shouldn't have done that. He says, but I can't give you a speeding ticket. So he says, but I can get you for drag racing because that's what drag racing is.
I was actually going to say, if you're speeding at the difference between $10,000 and a speeding ticket for however much is based on their determination that what's happening is a drag race. But right. If there's two cars going really fast, yeah. I assume that it's easy to spot, but there is some discretion there, right?
Yeah, what if you're way ahead? Is it still drag racing?
That wasn't even a race. I mopped the floor with him. I wouldn't really call it a race.
Yeah, fine him for being slow. But come on, cut me some slack here. The Riley championed ordinance also slaps fines of $500 a day on motorists whose mufflers are bypassed to make the engine sound louder. Which is another cool thing they do. I mean, you think you'd at least be a little sneaky about it, but no, you want your loud car. So it'd be interesting to see if anybody actually gets the $10,000 ticket, which, you know, would probably be pretty persuasive, right? I don't know who these guys are that are racing these cars in Chicago late at night, but you would think that $10,000 would cause you to take it out to Plainfield.
I'm going to say a guy who's drag racing on Lower Wacker Drive doesn't have $10,000 to pay the fine.
Maybe so. So, yeah, maybe. Well, what are you going to do then? I bet you could confiscate his car. The city's very good at that. Lots of texts here. 847, if the alligator is spooked by people around the park, why haven't they closed off the park to spectators? 269, is Trump attracted to, I'm not going to read that one. Why do they keep glorifying this whole process? Is that the process of catching the alligator? I think it's because it's fun. Carrie, you're on WGN Radio. Let me hit that button.
Hey, you know, if they're trying to track down people that are making noise in the middle of the night, they should come up to northern part of Lakeshore Drive. We're up by Wrigley Field, and every night the motorcycles come roaring up here, and I think somebody told me that Michael Jordan started that years ago.
Michael Jordan?
Yep.
Our Michael Jordan?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's what I heard.
We had a guy that worked here once, and his name was Michael Jordan, but it was a different Michael Jordan. The Michael Jordan was a motorcycle.
That's what I heard, that he started this. They race up Lakeshore Drive on their motorcycles in the middle of the night.
Yeah, yeah. I live not too far from there. There's a lot of commotion going on Halstead late at night, but that's entirely different. Well, let's see if this would cover that. That wouldn't be drag racing, and it said $500 for motorists, so I guess that would include motorcycles whose mufflers are bypassed.
But yeah.
Up north by Wrigley, huh?
Yep.
All right, thanks for the call, Carrie.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll bet they know where this is going on.
I can confirm that Michael Jordan was a motorcycle enthusiast. And I'm reading now that he had a failed motorsports team after he retired.
No kidding.
But I don't know if he was in the middle of the night. I can't speak to that. making noise. Also, it's not a noise complaint that they're raising these, you know, these fines, right? It's a safety concern. I mean,
I think it's a noise complaint, don't you?
Can you be fined $10,000 for making too much noise?
I think you should be. Riley.
Come on.
No, he did.
It has to be.
He said, here's the quote from the alderman. The penalty is astronomical by design. My hope is not a single citation is issued. My hope is they stop doing it. Well, yeah, so is he want them to stop doing it because they're dangerous, or it's because everybody's just bugged by the noise?
I did not think that it had to do with the noise before this conversation started.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
It's 1:23 on WGN. Speaking of noise, two sound bites for you to hear, one from former President Obama, which I thought of after hearing one from current President Donald Trump. Quick text here about the governor canceling the performance of that band called Confederate Railroad. 93% of you said he shouldn't. 630 texts in and said, John, would a band named Nazi Railroad be welcomed? Maybe that band needs to hire a marketing consultant. And 224 texted in and said, John, drag racing is a hilarious image. Yeah, I totally own that. If you just want to see something ridiculous, imagine me drag racing. So what were those two sound bites? The president was at some sort of event, and he spoke at great length, and there were a number of people that got a turn at the podium, and it was about kidney health and an executive order that he signed that evidently was going to free up funds or push forward kidney health for people in America. At one point in that presentation, he spoke extemporaneously, and this is what he said.
The kidney has a very special place in the heart. It's an incredible thing. People that have to go to this, people that have loved ones that are working so hard to stay alive. They have to work so hard.
So social media blows up on that because he said the kidney has a special place in the heart. Now, Donald Trump knows where the kidneys are, and you don't need to dance on that awkward phrase. But as soon as he said that, you knew that people were just going to go, oh, my God. And in fact, when he said the kidney has a special place in the heart, he sort of put his hand on his chest as if to say, I don't mean literally, but I mean, you know, a special place in the heart. Griff, play that soundbite one more time. Can we hear the crowd sort of laughing because they know he was just playing with the phrase?
The kidney has a very special place in the heart. It's an incredible thing. People that have to go.
There's a little hubbub there, isn't there?
Oh, wait a minute. So you're saying they're laughing because they know he's having fun with it?
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
You're making that up.
I don't hear that at all.
They're laughing because it's uncomfortable because he clearly misspoke.
Well, what do you think he meant?
I don't know what he meant. I think it's just indicative for when other times you hear him talking in the same manner. You know, I think that's when he riffs.
Well, this was him riffing, but I think, so it was maybe an awkward turn of the phrase, but I think it was somewhat deliberate, and I think he knows that the kidney is not in the heart, right?
Yeah,
but
I don't think he even misspoke. I think he meant what he said. It's just, it's just indicative of the kind of word salad that he's always engaging.
So in the future, when you hear him say, many people say, or other things like that,
yeah,
you know that there might not be a lot of basis behind it, but... No, he didn't mean... I don't think he meant to say that. I don't think he meant to say that the kidney has a special place in our heart. I think he just started talking and words came out. Do you think he meant to say that?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like the liver has a special place in our heart because need it for the bile it produces, or...
I wouldn't say any of those sentences, but I think he thought that would be cheeky. So does that...
Oh, you mean like a quick turn of the phrase sort of thing?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So do you think that, I said, but I immediately thought of Barack Obama and something he once said.
It is just wonderful to be back in Oregon. And over the last 15 months, we've traveled to every corner of the United States. I've now been in 57 states. I think one left to go. Alaska and Hawaii, I was not allowed to go to, even though I really wanted to visit, but my staff would not justify it.
Shortly after we got to know Donald Trump, and we would sometimes question his judgment or wisdom, people would throw that one at me all the time. They'd say, well, Barack Obama doesn't even know how many states there are. And those people, when I think they were putting one up against the other, were serious. They actually thought Barack Obama wasn't sure how many states in the union there are. So I would counter with, you can't believe that. It's a joke. He's just talking about how much he's traveled. It's a saying. It's an expression. And I thought I was feeling a little of that with the kidney statement from the president today.
No, I think it was more like the airport statement and the 4th of July speech where... No, you're laughing. I'm not laughing. Well, no. I'm not making fun or anything. I just think he starts talking down a road and he doesn't quite know where it's going to end up and different things come out. Yeah. That's what I think it's an example of, which I do too sometimes.
Oh, hello. The thing that he said at the social media summit yesterday, I thought, and Griff, I know we don't have time, so maybe we'll make room for this a little later on, but he has this social media summit, which Twitter and Google were not invited to. Facebook wasn't there, but there were some other people that were, and he started to talk about his count on his tweets and his followers. And that, I think, is worth exploring. So we'll get to that a little later on. Plus, Mike Vec will join us after the news into the WGN Radio Newsroom now. Steve, voice to text is an imperfect technology. It's really awesome, but sometimes you get texts from people and you know what they're talking about, but because the voice to text isn't translating them exactly, you don't really talk about a word salad, know what they're saying.
Right.
We were talking about the president and Barack Obama's statements and comparing them before the news. 630 texted in and said, John, you are on believable what year the fence of Donald Trump all the time is so disgusting. So I know that person feels strongly about something.
I could not agree more.
Somebody is disgusting about something and I'm in that mix. And 312 said, do you really believe Trump knows where the kidneys are? 847, though, says, John, the Edens is a drag strip every Sunday night when I come back from the city. People are going to kill themselves. 847 said, guys with fast, loud cars tend to be overcompensating for perhaps some physical shortcomings. I say take the cars and make them pay huge fines. It's a threat to public safety. And finally, 815 said, I stayed over at my son's condo at Marina Towers the other night and was awakened at 1 a.m. by very loud and frightening sounds of drag racing. Thought it was motorcycles. I'm so happy to hear about the impending fines. Hopefully it will discourage it.
Disco sucks! Disco sucks! And we're never going to let them forget it! They're not going to shove it down our throats! We rock and rollers will resist, and we will triumph! All right, you ready? We're going to count to three, and then go boom!
They blew up the disco records.
Back in the ballpark, and I'm sure glad, and I hope they don't let you people see what's going on here at Comiskey Park. One of the saddest sights I've ever seen in a ballpark in my life. This garbage of demolishing a record has turned into a fiasco.
A very discouraged Jimmy Pearsall. Again, Chicago had this conversation a couple of weeks ago when the Sox did a promotion to honor the disco demolition of 40 years ago, but it's actually today, 40 years ago, that it happened. And when we were all talking about it, I tried to get Mike Vec on to share his thoughts with us, and we weren't able to connect. We were today, so the timing is going to work out after all. Hey, Mike, it's John. You're on WGN in Chicago. How are you?
I am well, thank you. I've enjoyed listening to a couple of those missives to you via this great technology. Some of those folks, they can really speak their mind, can't they, when you can't see their face?
Well, they...
I'm sorry.
Trying to have a serious conversation with you, Mike Vec. Mike, what is your relationship with the St. Paul Saints baseball team?
I'm a co-owner.
Co-owner of the team. And you are Mike Vec, so you are the son of the Vec that owned the Chicago White Sox back in the day then, right?
Yes, the grandson of the man who ran the Cubs back in the day. So we had our foot in both camps.
So Bill Vec and Mike Vec. And when, Mike, what was your position with the White Sox 40 years ago?
I was the marketing director and assistant business manager, as I recall.
Whose idea was disco demolition?
In 1977, it was mine is the short answer. In 1977, we did a disco promotion tied in with Jimmy Rittenberg at Faces and all of the clubs in Chicago that were playing disco music. And we retired to Miller's Pub, and around 3 in the morning, Jeff Schwartz, who was a record plugger at the time, said to me, "We ought to do a night for people who just love old-fashioned rock and roll." And we had a big laugh about it. I said, "Yeah, we ought to call it anti-disco night or something." And 2 years later, Jeff Schwartz called me up, and he said, "There's a guy who just blew up a disco record on WLUP named Steve Dahl. You remember that anti-disco night?" I said, "Yeah." And so that was it. I knocked on the door at WLUP, had never heard Steve, never met him. And back in those days, he was working 6 to 10, and at 10:05, I knocked on the studio door and said, "You want to try that in person at Comiskey Park for one of our teen nights?" And he said, "No, I did one in Indiana a couple weeks ago at a shopping center. It didn't work so well." I said, "Well, maybe we can figure this out." So that was how Disco Demolition came about.
Did you have an opinion about disco music per se yourself?
The day I got out of Loyola, I joined a rock and roll band and spent almost 4 years on the road. And the moment I heard the first disco record, which for me was Casey and the Sunshine Band, I knew that I was about to be replaced by a drum machine. And as it turned out, I was. We were playing four-piece and got fired. And I just didn't want to play disco music.
So you didn't.
And so I had a very personal dislike for disco.
I understand that. So you didn't like the music, but you also said that you had, in fact, done a disco night—not a disco demolition, but a disco exhibition or celebration at Sox Park previously, right?
Yeah, in 1977, which was, you know, except for the founding year of the Saints, 93, 1977, the Southside Hitmen. With Zisk and Gamble combining for 61 home runs, Eric Soderholm. Most exciting year I've ever had in the ballpark. The curtain calls, na na hey hey. But we did also a tribute to disco. And we drew 25,000. So even though I didn't care it, I was an equal opportunity guy. That year we didn't need as much help. I mean, in 79 when we did Disco Demolition, I mean, we were in kind of the same boat that the White Sox were in this year when they finally acknowledged that it happened at their ballpark.
So a couple of years.
39 years after the fact.
So a couple of years then before you blew up the records, you actually put, stages out on the warning track. Is that right?
Yeah, it was very, it's interesting that you know that, John. I'm impressed. It is elaborate that we put 25 polished platform out around the warning track and invited the finalists from every club in Chicago to come and dance and ultimately pick the winner. But it was astounding to me how quickly and how many people and just how many dance clubs there were for I was blown away. But yeah, we did it 2 years before Disco Demolition. We honored the art of disco dancing.
So then a couple of years later, Dahl's a big deal, and you say, "Hey, you want to do this." And I'm just wondering what your impetus was. You said that you didn't like disco music that much, but it was just, "Hey, let's find another way to get people at the ballpark," or did you shake your fist to disco music and say, "I'll show you"? Were you like Dahl, or were you just trying to get people in the building?
I was, first and foremost, I was trying to get people in the building. That's what I, you know, figured that my job was, but I had a little personal stake in it. I really didn't care for it.
Yeah. Right.
I don't know that I was shaking my fist at it, but I, you know, it certainly was never made its way into the box in my car driving to work.
So how do you remember what happened that night then? How do you feel about that today?
Well, as you know, I spent a lot of time talking to Dave Hoekstra, the great writer, and I guess and also on your station once in a while. But Dave really wrote the definitive and about Disco Demolition. And I said, the thing that people don't realize is the mistake was mine, not for the idea so much as the cops. We always had a meeting with all of our off-duty security in the afternoon, and they came as was normal, and they said, how many people are you going to have? And this was a twilight rescheduled doubleheader. And when I told them we were going to have 35,000 people, you would have thought that Penn and Teller had reunited. I mean, they were laughing. They thought that was not possible. We were not a very good ball club, way out already of the pennant race, didn't even qualify. And I said we were going to have 35,000 people. And at 3 o'clock, I looked out, and there were 35,000 people lined up. The problem was old Comiskey had portable ticket booths. And there were so many people out. There were 60,000 people in the park by a half hour into game time. There were 40,000 people outside the park trying to get in. When they started to shake the portable ticket booths, I had to move some of the security from the field out to the front gates to get the kids to stop rattling the portable ticket booths. So crowd control is a misnomer. When they had the Stones the other night, if 75,000 people decided to take down Soldier Field, they would. But they never think as one. In this particular time, they looked and saw that I had moved 15 cops off the field, and they decided that they were going to run on the field, take control of their own field. Yeah. And they did. But up until that moment, I had thought, you know, we've just set the all-time attendance record.
So until they stormed the field,
Chicago.
So then before they, yeah, no kidding, before they stormed the field, you thought things were going well. I mean, it's an unruly or a large crowd, but until they stormed the field, it was, you thought you had a handle on it, right?
Yes, and the other thing that people tend to forget with crowd control is if Pearsall, who is not one of my favorites, was not one of my favorites. We had a particularly prick.
Shoot, he just cut out.
But the fact is that we had several disagreements, but Pearsall. But had that been a baseball crowd, and they'd been drinking, it would have been a real problem. But a lot of these kids were so stoned that it was very peaceful. Yes, people were throwing records occasionally on the field, but I gave away Reggie bars the first time they were ever given away, and they threw 20,000 of those at Reggie, you know. So, I mean, it wasn't because we didn't collect the records. Some of the kids hid them when they came in.
Well, let me ask you about this, though, Mike. So a couple of weeks ago when we were recollecting more specifically the event, and to me, for a long time, it felt like the 85 Bears. It was just one of those great stories, great in quotes, you know, famous stories in Chicago that people talked about. But when they talk about it of late, they talk about it in different terms. They talk about maybe the racism or the homophobic attitudes that maybe were also driving that crowd. I don't know if you have anything to say about that. Were you paying attention to the conversations that were going on here in Chicago last few weeks?
I'm aware of it. I've heard, you know, one of the Gibb brothers had pointed that out once we were on a show together. But I can tell you, and in this case, since it could be a little bit controversial, it was my idea. It never occurred to me that I would be offending anyone. Would I do it today? Of course I wouldn't do it today. Through the lens darkly, I understand that things change. But I can assure you that 40 years ago, when it popped into my head, it was simply a very vertical promotion that we had already done a disco promotion. Now was a chance to do a thing for the rockers. And there was no discussion during the time. And I was on the field the whole time. Long after Dahl had left the building, I was still on the field. There was no discussion about it being any of those particularly distasteful, whether it was racist or homophobic, or it was simply a celebration of rock and roll versus disco dancing.
I got to go. Do you own the phrase disco demolition?
It's amazing. This is a great country where a guy can have an idea and Steve Dahl can copyrighted.
I'm afraid I thought so. Was that's where that
yeah,
was going to go.
I, I was sorry I didn't get my peach from the T-shirt giveaway the other day. But at least they finally admitted that it really did happen on the South Side.
And it was your idea. All right. Nice to talk to you, Mike. When you come to Chicago, I'm sure you come through here once in a while. Swing through our studio, okay?
I would love to. I'm coming next week to speak. I'll give you a ring.
I hope so. Mike Vec is, by the way, the author, too, of a book that is actually really clever and fun. It's called Another Boring Derivative Piece of Crap Business Book. I don't know if you remember the name Abby Malbon, but she was this really inspiring young lady that Steve Cochran had on his show not that long ago. We invited her back to our studios just for a few minutes today to plug something she's got coming up this weekend. And Abby is back in the WGN Radio studios. Abby, welcome back. How are you?
Thank you for having me. Good. How are you?
Real good. So as I recall from your show, your conversation with Steve Cochran, you graduated high school early.
Yes.
Where'd you go to high school?
I went to high school, Matilla Valley High School in Aurora.
In Aurora. And are going to, in the fall, the University of Illinois?
Yes. I'm going to the U of I and I'm studying social work.
Kudos to you.
Thank
U of
you.
I. Hooray. And you are actually putting on an event this weekend, which is called With Dignity, which has been your cause. And in fact, this is your event, correct?
Yes.
I don't know many 18-year-olds who are this socially able and active. What is this event all about?
So the event is to continue the conversation about the Learn with Dignity Act, which is enacted in the state of Illinois that requires all public high schools and middle schools to supply their students with free menstrual products and bathrooms. So that's why I was on the show earlier. I've been an activist for it. I've been advocating for it for a couple of years now. And I, through my activism, got connected with this girl at Naperville Central, and we planned this event. It's going to be at the Harold Washington Library tomorrow from 2:30 to 4:30.
So it's not just the access to whatever you would need, like use the restroom, but it was also free access to the products?
Yes.
I see. Because is that an issue for some people, low income or something like that?
Oh, definitely, yeah. And even not low income, I feel like some people are maybe too scared to ask a parent to purchase them. Or they just don't have the access to a car, things like that. So having them accessible.
Is it an embarrassing thing, too, maybe for young students to ask an adult at school, I need to go to the restroom?
Yeah, I mean, for some, it is embarrassing. I would hope it's not embarrassing. That's the whole point of this event, is to have people say the word tampon and pad in a safe space. And I think to create awareness about this and to make it as accessible as other bathroom necessities like paper towels and toilet paper. But the whole point of this is to make it not embarrassing. It's to destigmatize menstruation.
And those products are not free and available in a women's restroom at a high school?
No, they're not. At least before I started advocating for this, they weren't available in restrooms.
What did you do when you told, what did the school board or principal or the adults say when you said, hey, we got to do this?
They didn't respond to me. That was one of the things that I was super passionate about, was getting an email response. So when they didn't respond to me, I showed up at the school board meeting and I essentially filibustered it with help of my fellow students. So it took a lot for them to even say the word tampon and pad.
So is this law now? It has to be the case now?
Yes. So it is a law. It went into effect in 2018. But the problem is it has no funding. So a lot of schools aren't motivated to enforce it because they don't necessarily have the funds to enforce it strictly.
If you're a school district that has financial problems, you still have a lot of money. You still have resources. It would be amazing to me that this would be an economic burden for a school district. They're just dragging their heels is what it
Yeah, definitely.
Sounds like to me.
And also in the point that you made about schools that don't have a big budget, it's those school districts that need them the most. It's those school districts with the most low-income students.
So the event to have panel discussions about this. Mm-hmm. There's also an art show and a panel discussion is called With Dignity. It's at the Harold Washington Library in the U Media Center. Is that what
yes.
you call it? And that's going to be from 2:30 to 4:30 tomorrow, free and open to the public.
Yes. And if you wanted to RSVP or get more information, we are on Instagram. It's menstruator.action. And all the information is on there. And the link to RSVP to the event is in the bio.
Mary Sandberg said, John, you've got to talk to this young lady because, A, this is a good idea. And because, B, you will be hearing from her in the future. She is going to be a power to be dealt with down the road in whatever her causes are. And I thoroughly believe that. It's nice to meet you. Good luck tomorrow.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
2:30 to 4:30 tomorrow. And the social media site is
menstruator.action.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
184.
Here's John Williams.
The Dow's up 184. Woohoo! USA, man. This is John. We're in the Allstate Skyline Studio till 3. And on Saturdays, we're here from 10 to noon. We got a swell little Saturday show I think you'll enjoy. I don't know what you do on Saturdays. What are you doing tomorrow morning? It's 10 a.m. Tomorrow, 10 a.m. Well, you're probably listening to Lou Manfredini, and then after that, we come on, and I think you'll enjoy that show, too. I'm reading from the November 28th issue of the Miami Herald last year. Palm Beach multimillionaire Jeffrey Epstein has been a free man, despite sexually abusing dozens of underage girls. According to police prosecutors, his victims have never had a voice until now. A decade before hashtag MeToo, a multimillionaire sex offender from Florida got the ultimate break on a muggy October morning in 2007. Miami's top federal prosecutor, Alexander Acosta, had a breakfast appointment with a former colleague, Washington, D.C. attorney Jay Lefkowitz. It was an unusual meeting for the then 38-year-old prosecutor, a rising Republican star who had served in several White House posts before being named U.S. Attorney in Miami by President George Bush. His client, Palm Beach multimillionaire Jeffrey Epstein, age 54, was accused of assembling a large cult-like network of underage girls with the help of young female recruiters to coerce into having sex acts behind the walls of his opulent waterfront mansion as often as three times a day. The eccentric hedge fund manager, whose friends include former President Bill Clinton, Donald Trump, and Prince Andrew, was also suspected of trafficking minor girls, often from overseas, for sex parties at his other homes in Manhattan, New Mexico, and the Caribbean. Facing a 53-page federal indictment, Epstein could have ended up in prison for the rest of his life, but on that morning of the breakfast meeting, a deal was struck, an extraordinary plea agreement that would conceal the full extent of Epstein's crimes and the number of people involved. Not only would Epstein serve just 13 months in a county jail, but the deal, called the non-prosecution agreement, essentially shut down an ongoing FBI probe into whether there were more victims and other powerful people who took part in Epstein's sex crimes. One last paragraph. The pact required Epstein to plead guilty to two prostitution charges in state court. Epstein and four accomplices named in the agreement received immunity from all federal criminal charges. Even more unusual, the deal included wording that granted immunity to any potential co-conspirators who were also involved in Epstein's crimes. This is the story of how Epstein, bolstered by unlimited funds and represented by a powerhouse legal team, was able to manipulate the criminal justice system, and how his accusers, still traumatized by their past, believe they were betrayed by the very prosecutors who pledged to protect them. And one of those prosecutors, of course, is Alexander Acosta, who until today was the labor secretary in the Trump administration. We reached out to Renato Mariotti, who is a former federal prosecutor and who has, I don't know. Renato, welcome back. Have you ever dealt with cases like this before?
Well, I certainly investigated human trafficking cases and sexual exploitation of minors cases, but never a case quite like this one, because it is an astounding case, a heinous case. For instance, I investigated a man who sexually exploited a number of children, but the sheer number that Mr. Epstein did dwarfs that by quite a substantial degree. So this is, I would say, an extraordinary case by any measure, but I certainly handled cases of this type.
Well, as a former federal prosecutor, what do you make of the deal that they were, that Epstein's people were able to get from Acosta's people?
I would call it extraordinary, and I mean that in the ordinary sense of the term. It's a very unusual deal. Typically, when the feds are zeroing in on somebody who has exploited a minor, you are very reluctant to do any kind of deal that isn't going to result in criminal charges. I will tell you, I had a case where I was investigating federally federal charges against someone who had exploited minors, and I ultimately, we didn't bring federal charges, state charges were brought because of a lack of evidence. So it does happen, But I will say that, you know, here, some of the unusual things about this agreement are that it purports to immunize co-conspirators. And it's really hard to understand why the United States of America would agree to do that. In other words, why would a federal prosecutor say that we're not going to bring charges against all these co-conspirators? You're not negotiating with the co-conspirator. You're negotiating with Epstein. Very unusual. It's also that the agreement seems to be very sloppily drafted because the Justice Department only allows U.S. attorneys' offices to bind their own office. In other words, there's a U.S. attorney here in Chicago. I used to work. There's one in Miami, and they're all over the place. You don't want to have it so that every office has to get the permission of every other office when they enter an agreement. But there are steps that the justice manual that U.S. attorneys have to follow put forward so that you limit your agreements just to that particular office. Some of the language here suggests that they were trying to limit it. Some of it does not. It's very sloppy, and it's going to be a point of contention in the current Epstein agreement. So there's a lot of things that are unusual about it. Of course, the most unusual is that they failed to notify the victims as required by law, and of course, that's been a subject of great controversy.
I wonder what would motivate them to then cut such a good deal for Epstein.
Yeah, it raises really important questions. Okay, what Secretary Acosta got up and said yesterday was that it was all due to a lack of evidence or proof issues that they had. And as I said, in and of itself, that's plausible in the abstract. But when you get down to the specifics of this case, you actually had a 53-page draft indictment that was drafted by the federal office that Mr. Acosta used to head up, and that the former state's attorney, the Palm Beach County state attorney, said yesterday, he issued a statement saying if Mr. Acosta was truly concerned with the state's case and felt he had to rescue the matter, he would have moved forward with the 53-page indictment that his own office drafted. Instead, Mr. Acosta brokered a secret plea deal. Mr. Acosta should not be allowed to rewrite history. Very strong words from the state's attorney there that seems to contradict what Mr. Acosta put forward yesterday, a version of events that in which he essentially was blaming the victims by saying that they were going back on their story.
I want to talk to you about that evidence thing, but, you know, the Miami Herald didn't have much trouble finding people that were willing to talk about it. It seems to me like there's evidence everywhere in this case.
It certainly does. So what I would say is, based upon my review of the investigative journalism that was done by the Miami Herald, there's an ample number of victims who were willing to come forward and testify against Epstein, and it looked to me like there was very credible evidence there.
Some of them are 14, by the way. Keep going.
Yeah. And then obviously, as we know, the Southern District of New York U.S. Attorney's Office determined there was sufficient evidence to go forward now with charges. Now, it is currently 2019. Mr. Acosta was considering charges back in 2007. There's no way that the evidence is going to be better in 2019 than it is in 2007. Memories get worse over time. It's always the evidence is going to be better closer to the event. I mean, certainly there are exceptions to that, but that's the general rule. And so I don't want to say that I don't know for certain what all the evidence is that Mr. Acosta had in front of him, but it's very questionable. And you can see why people are outraged about it.
Well, there's a number of cases that have come through Chicago lately where now we're all playing armchair prosecutor or juror, but we say, in the case of Jussie Smollett or R. Kelly, don't you guys make those decisions? Let's put it in front of a jury or a judge and let them decide. I understand how prosecutors are loath to bring cases they don't think they can win, but maybe you don't know and you ought to go ahead and give it a try before you say, drop charges or cut somebody a sweetheart deal.
Well, I will say that These are the type of cases where prosecutors are more likely to do it. So when I was a prosecutor, we often were very careful about, as you've pointed out, bringing cases that we knew we could win, that we were very confident that we were certain we could win, because federal prosecutors are faced with lots of different possible cases they can bring, and they have to pick and choose amongst them. So you should choose, you know, logic says you should choose your strongest cases and let the state handle the remainder of them. But on these are the type of cases where the office, my former office, was willing to take gambles and take a case that, you know, they thought they could prove, but there was some risk there because the danger to victims, to minor victims, is so great. So there's been a number of those cases in the past that my former office took. I think they did that again today with R. Kelly. I think this is another case where obviously there was a prior not guilty verdict from on the state side for R. Kelly, and they decided it was in the public interest to go forward. And I think that's what the Southern District did. They took a little bit of a risk as well with that prosecution, knowing Epstein's got a lot of resources, and really took the offensive back in 2007 against the Southern District of Florida.
Well, maybe you just answered the question that was on my head then, because I'm like, well, what's the risk? If the risk is that we won't win, and that's embarrassing to a federal prosecutor, I would hate for that to be the reason that they wouldn't prosecute a case. But if putting these women through the trauma of having to testify, and you don't win, and so you've traumatized them again, it sounds like that's what you're saying, Renato, that's the risk, huh?
There's even more to it than that. So let's say there's a not guilty verdict in a high profile case. Let's say Mr. Epstein proceeded to trial, and there really were proof issues. I'm not saying that there were. There was not, but let's say there's really evidentiary issues, and you lose trial, and he's not guilty on all those counts. What it sends the message to is that you can commit serious crimes and get away with it. Potentially to people who are considering wrongdoing, or it tells victims that maybe their rights aren't, you know, can't be vindicated, or that coming forward doesn't achieve results. Now, you can debate it. I mean, not bringing the charges, you know, there can be a reasonable debate about it, but you could imagine it's sending the wrong message. Similarly, it also is a credibility issue for the office. In other words, if you're a prosecutor, you want defendants to say, okay, if they bring charges, they probably got it. They can prove them. And you don't want them to think that, you know, half the time they could beat it.
Former federal prosecutor Renato Mariotti is on a phone line. So then they say, okay, how about two counts of prostitution? I think one with a minor. You go to jail for 18 months. You really only serve 13. You get out for half a day. You can hire your own private security team to make sure your life is safe and comfortable. What do you make of that part of the agreement?
Well, I mean, I think with all of this, what I think listeners are probably getting a sense of is that justice is different for the rich and powerful. And what happened here is Mr. Epstein hired attorneys who were very aggressive. And there's been public reports that they started investigating the prosecutors in the case. I will say, when I was a federal prosecutor, that I was the subject of defense counsel at times making attacks against me personally. That happens when you are going up against very well compensated, aggressive defense counsel. That's just part of the nature of the business. And
What does that even mean? They're aggressive. Mm-hmm. I mean, sure, they're aggressive. They're working for their client. But what do they tell you? They're going to break your kneecaps? What do you care if they're aggressive?
Sure. Great question. So sometimes that may involve making allegations that the attorneys are engaged in misconduct. Sometimes it means making allegations that the attorneys are lying to the court and trying to personalize the issues and go after the attorneys personally, say that they're, you know, there have been times where prosecutors or attorneys have had disciplinary actions opened against them by defense counsel. You know, I don't know here exactly what the nature was of the sort of investigation that they were doing of the attorneys personally, but I do know more broadly that what I've just talked to you about has occurred.
Yeah.
For me, the situation was defense counsels accusing me of misconduct and so on, and the judge disagreed with them. But in both cases, it was very, you know, expensive, very aggressive defense attorneys who were trying to do whatever they could for their client, and they thought that that would put me on the defensive.
Okay. So then you've got so now Acosta and his people allow this to go forward. It's not going to be a federal case. He'll get the sweetheart deal at state charges. The FBI investigation is shut down,
right.
And I don't know how that office felt about that. If they thought, okay, that's the best we can do. Or maybe because it's a billionaire or multimillionaire and these people have connections, there's a network I don't know about, and it was just too awkward for them to punish this guy to the full extent of the law. He then becomes labor secretary. I wonder in the vetting of him if this would have... wait, I know this came up, but I wonder how they were able to look around that.
It's a great question. I know there's been some public reporting about the vetting process of various nominees and how various red flags were raised and many were ignored. I don't know what the process was over there, but you would think that this is something that would be a significant red flag. I will say, though, to the credit of the journalist, Julie Brown, who did this investigative reporting for the Miami Herald, is, you know, this was considered a dead case, an old case, a case that people weren't thought was in the past but weren't as interested in, and perhaps the administration thought that there would not be the level of public concern and fallout that there has been.
Well, clearly the president didn't think it was that big of an issue, and I asked Steve Bertrand, I said, you know, isn't it possible that you could have, you know, made a big mistake as a former federal prosecutor or a plumber, whatever, but now you have this new job, and the president said he seemed to be a terrific labor secretary. So isn't it possible that one doesn't necessarily affect the other? Steve said, well, the labor secretary is also in charge of child labor laws and those sorts of things. And if a guy is prostituting children and this guy, trafficking children, thank you, Griffin, and this guy didn't do enough to intervene in that case, the last job he should have would be one as a labor secretary. I suppose you see the symmetry there, huh?
For sure, and there was also people talking about, I guess, the Acosta slashed some funding for human trafficking work that the department was doing. I would just say as well that this isn't a question of judgment, and if somebody is and what appears to potentially be potential corruption by Mr. Acosta, or at the very least very bad judgment on his part, you want somebody in a position of authority to exercise proper judgment and to be free of undue or unwarranted influence.
Last comment from you, Renato Mariotti.
I think it, what this should tell all of us is that when there is potential exploitation of children, we should report it and we should encourage victims to come forward.
It's too bad that somebody has to say that, but yeah, I'm glad you did. Renato Mariotti, former federal prosecutor here in Chicago. As always, thanks for your time and expertise, Renato.
Thank you very much.
It's 2:27. This is WGN. Well, the bright side is right around the corner. We do that on Fridays. We tell you some fun things to do over the weekend, and then we all chime in and say, you know, here's my good news of the week. And we won't miss our appointment with that after the news. The news is next on WGN.
She ladled the conversation, skimming from the top. That damn helium balloon from last year still refuses to pop.
What are we listening to, Griff?
This is a Chicago band called Ohm. They're going to be at the Square Roots Festival in Lincoln Square tomorrow at 5:15.
I like this. Do you like this band?
They're fantastic. Yes, I love them.
How do you spell the name?
O-H-M-M-E. Ohm.
Is that a last name? Ohm?
I'm actually not sure.
O-H-M-M-E.
It's meditative.
Yeah, no kidding. Oh, Ohm is, right. But this is typical for them?
Yeah, this is, yeah.
Give me a little more. Fun things to do this weekend. All right, Lauren Lapka and I are in Studio D, and we've got some other things you might want to do besides check out the music from Ohm. What do you like?
Oh, man, well... a lot of food.
Ohm man, I get it.
Yeah,
Ohm man.
A lot of food experiences. I know you're going to mention the big one, but I just want to also mention there is Taste of Westmont and Taste of Park Ridge throughout the weekend in those respective areas. Kind of very similar to the big one you're about to mention. A lot of great food, live entertainment, just a good time all around.
The big one is at Grant Park, Taste of Chicago, the world's largest food festival, is held for 5 days here. It includes Saturday and Sunday. It's free to get in. You pay for the food. It's in Grant Park. There's music as well. It's really crowded. Enjoy. What else you got?
We also have the Irish American Heritage Festival. That starts tonight at 6. $10 in advance, $15 at the door, but obviously a lot of great Irish American music, dancing, family activities. And that's over at the IAHC building on North Knox.
Windy City Smokeout is at the United Center. They got the big festival up at the UC. Buy and sell Windy City Smokeout Festival Chicago tickets for July 13th at the United Center on StubHub. It's $49.99 on StubHub. It's today and tomorrow through the afternoon, or it starts at noon each day, and it's the big Windy City Smokeout Festival over at the UC.
Something unique going on. It's called the Outside Experience, but this is kind of everything involving the latest gear and adventure vehicles. You can paddle on Lake Michigan. You can demo mountain bikes and an indoor mountain bike like dirt path. So that's kind of crazy. There's adventure films, a cornhole tournament, pretty much something from morning to night. And that's over by the McCormick Place area.
Over by McCormick Place. I'm actually talking to somebody who's speaking there tomorrow. And that's called the Outside Adventure Festival. What's the name
of
that?
It's just Outside Experience.
That's what, yeah, Outside Experience. So for those of you that like outdoor stuff, and the guy we're talking to tomorrow is the only person to go to the North Pole, the South Pole, and Mount Everest in the same year. He did all three. His name is Eric Larson, and he gives amazing TED Talks about it, and he's still alive, which is amazing. He'll be on with us tomorrow. Oh, you'll want to hear his stories at 10:35. Cubs, as you've been hearing, are at Wrigley Field against the Pirates. That game's ongoing. It's 1:20 first pitch tomorrow. Tickets about $60, depending on where you want to sit. We got walk-up for $20. What have you got?
There's also Parade of Boats, so this is the whole kickoff to the race to Mackinac. That's tomorrow, 10 to 2, and they will kick off from Navy Pier at the east end. So pretty cool if you are a big fan of boats and sailing, things like that.
I get the feeling we could do this for the whole half hour.
Oh, wow.
Let's just do two more. Roscoe Village is having its Burger Fest. That's tomorrow and Sunday. It's free to get in. Burger Fest, all the best burgers in town. The grills are all fired up. And if you're a true crime podcast fan, they're having the big true crime podcast festival at the Chicago Marriott downtown. $125 to go to that, but those of you that are there, the podcasters you love are in Chicago, the podcast crime festival. One more from you.
I will say the Chinatown 5K, that's Saturday. There are registration fees. It's about 7:30 or 8. It kicks off. I would also mention the Chicago Bears run. That's also 7:30 a.m. on Saturday, but it's sold out.
Here's the deal about Chicago. It's a great city. I think we overfest ourselves.
Oh, we do.
And I really mean it. I think that they should cancel some of these things or have them for fewer days because there's so much you want to do. And you're all, oh, shoot, I can't cross Columbus or Lakeshore Drive because there's a run or a walk or a something K. To say nothing of the festivals and then Grant Park. And we haven't even gotten to Lollapalooza yet. And so the people that are just coming to see the fountain and enjoy the city sometimes don't get to do it the way it was originally intended because there's some event going on.
Well, at least they get to experience something that everyday Chicagoans do, and that is awful traffic. So it's very authentic.
The bright side. This is your chance to call in now. 312-981-7200. We're handing out Bright Side of Life pins, courtesy of our friends at the Joint Relief Institute, made by some very clever people at Big League Pins. They say Bright Side on there. It's a nice sun, and you'll enjoy wearing that or sharing it with your friends. So get your pins and call us now. Tell us some good news in your world. The Bright Side is next. Thank you, sir. By the way, 312-981-7200. Call or text right now. It's time for The Bright Side, 312-981-7200. Also on social media, I'm WGN King John on my Facebook page. You can also post your Bright Sides. It's a nice collection of happy there, and we're handing out some of those pins. This is our little song.
Some things in life are bad.
Here we go now.
They can really make you mad.
I don't see Kevin in sports.
Other things just make you swear and curse.
There goes our celebrity guest whistle.
When you're chewing on life's gristle, that grumble.
Lauren Lapka, are you going to be able to whistle for us?
I'm not very good at it. I can try.
I'm not sure Kevin's real good either. Here we go. Sing at home. Always.
Always look on the bright side of life.
Yeah, Kevin's much always better.
Look on the second one is the one where we nail it. Here we go.
If life seems jolly rotten, there's something you've forgotten.
Griff, are you able to whistle?
No.
Were you trying over there? You were kind of leaning in. I had your mic turned down.
No, I was looking to you as if to say,
oh, don't come to me.
Nope.
Don't come to me for whistling. Let's start with Kim Gordon in the WGN Radio Newsroom. Kim, give me your bright side.
Jennifer Hudson at Ravinia on Sunday.
My bright side, Max Strus. The sharp shooting super forward from DePaul is now a Boston Celtic. Actually, he's in the D-League. He's got to do well in order to make the club with Brad Stevens and company. And last night, we were able to see him on TV. He had a really nice game. Go, Strucci. What a nice representative for DePaul. Lapka, what's your bright side?
My bright side is that the All-Star break is finally over.
Griffin, you got a bright side for us?
I've got a full weekend this weekend. I'm excited.
A full weekend. Oh, just a whole bunch of fun things to do?
2 days off.
There you go.
Always look on the light side of life.
Let's start with Laura, 312-981-7200. Call me now. You'll get in. Hi, Laura. You're on the air. What's your bright side?
Well, you'd think it was that I was married for 20 years and celebrating my anniversary at the State House at the Edgewater in Madison, and was having a nice dinner, and at the end of the meal, we were waiting for the bill to come, and they said the gentleman at the table next to us heard it was our anniversary, and he paid for the whole thing.
Wow.
It was $200.
Wow.
$200.
Happy anniversary.
That's right.
Wow.
Thank you.
Yeah, well, that just works on both levels. It's nice that guy's out there, and happy anniversary to you. Thanks for calling, Laura.
Thanks.
All right, Lapka, it's your turn.
All right, I like this one. 630, my bright side is I managed to make it another day without being eaten by Chance the Snapper. So always
look on the bright side of life. Hey, Matt, you're on WGN. Why are you smiling today, sir?
Well, countdown continues, 34 days until my first vacation in 3 years, King John, and I cannot wait.
We're anxious for you, buddy. I'll talk to you in a week.
Yes, sir.
I don't know that guy, but he's decided to share with us his countdown to vacation. We're all rooting for Matt. Let's talk to Larry. You're on WGN. Hey, Larry, what's your bright side? You're on the air.
Hi there. A 37-year career, now 8.5 years of retirement and counting. Two great kids, two beautiful grandchildren. And I'm going to see Jennifer Hudson Sunday.
How about
and
that?
I'm going to see Jeremy Piven, thanks to WGN and WGN, because I won tickets last week.
Wow.
You know, though, I like the first part of that, too. Sometimes, hey, I got up, I have a nice family, it's sunny. That's a bright side right there. Thank you, Larry. You must always face the curtain. All right, Lauren Lapka, your turn.
Another 616. We finally got a pontoon boat at our house, but more importantly, I was just offered a teaching job at Grand Valley State University.
Hey, let's see. Matt, we've already talked to you, right? Or no, have we? Matt, are you there?
No, I'm a different Matt, John.
Hey, what's up? What's your bright side?
My bright side is that I live about 15 miles into Wisconsin, and it's another day closer to January 1st in Illinois for marijuana legalization.
If life seems jolly rotten, there's something you've forgotten. And that's to love and smile and dance.
Susan, you're on WGN. What's your bright side?
My bright side is I'm 63 years old, I'm going on a date, and I'm still feeling high school fluttery.
Oh, nice. Is this a first date with this person, or what?
It's the second one, so the flutter's a little bit more. Always look on the
bright side of life. Talk to me, Jody. You're on WGN. What's your bright side?
Hi, John. My wife is 43 years old, and she's going to graduate school. I'm so proud of her.
I've been thinking lately about people who, later in life, you know, decide, I'm going to go back to school for whatever reason. I think that's fantastic. Good luck to her, Jody.
I'm so proud of her.
Lauren Lapka, give me a bright side.
847, Sunday they leave for Disney World to celebrate their 50th wedding anniversary with their daughter, son-in-law, and granddaughters.
I haven't given out any Bright Side of Life pins, and I see Kevin is over in Sportsland. Hey, Kevin, you going to share a bright side with us?
Yeah, I'm happy. I'm stealing Lauren's thunder again. Baseball's back, and I'm pumped, and we're celebrating some birthdays this week. My mom, my brother-in-law, should be a fun weekend. Sorry I missed the whistle earlier, too.
You didn't not...
I failed.
you did not blow that off because you didn't want a whistle, was it?
No, I was stuck in a very important pre-show meeting.
Always look on the bright side.
Whistle here if you like. It wasn't bad.
It was okay. It's all right. Look on the
bright side of life. Carl, you're on WGN. What's your bright side, sir?
Hey, how you doing, Jack? Hey, John, I'm going to college at DuPage tonight. First outdoor summer concert to go see my old classmate, Jim Peterick, and the Ides of March.
Wow. Oh, that'll be fun. Is that outdoors, yeah, by the way?
Yeah. Yeah, oh. Lakeside Pavilion.
Oh,
yeah,
nice. Hi, boy, Carl. Thanks for the call. Hey, Griff said, give pins to these people. So Karen and Cheryl, stay there. And if you want to hurry up, call 312-981-7200. Lapka, let's give a Bright Side of Life pin to whom?
I like this one. This one's a nice, unique one. 217, got a 1923 Model T running for the first time since 1984.
Wow. All right, save that person there. We'll make sure they get a Bright Side of Life pin. You got one more you want to read?
Sure. 630, my wife and I, that is their wife and I, them, closed on their first house on Monday, or will.
Yeah.
Adulting 101, hashtag.
Yeah, no kidding. That's a terrifying, exciting thing.
Yes.
Oh, and Karen, you're on WGN. You're going to get a Bright Side pin, Carol. Karen, what's your Bright Side?
I finally located Lower Wacker Drive, and I can get home so fast now.
Oh,
I'm very excited.
Do not tell anybody where it is, because...
I won't.
Isn't that an amazing thing if you've never done it before?
It is fabulous. I love it. I absolutely love it. I'm so excited.
If you're down by, say, the Tribune Tower, if you're at the river and Michigan Avenue, and you need to get to the Eisenhower, that'll save you 20 minutes.
I actually had to use it this morning to get around all the traffic on the Dan Ryan and Lakeshore Drive. Lifesaver.
Okay, hold on. Talk to Griff. Cheryl, you're on WGN. What's your bright side, Cheryl?
Well, first of all, it's a gorgeous day in Chicago.
Yay.
This past year, I finished my 27th year of teaching, and I still had 6 weeks of vacation before I start my 28th year of teaching.
Ah, are you enjoying your summer?
I am. It's great.
Yeah, no kidding.
But people don't realize, for teachers, though, it's really recovery time, though, because there's so much energy and so much that you give to the kids all year that you really need that time to just recharge and be ready for the next year.
Hold on. Get one of those Bright Side of Life pins from producer Griffin from our friends at the Joint Relief Institute. And finally, Joanne, you're on WGN. What's your bright side, Joanne?
My bright side is my nephew Jimmy is celebrating his 23rd birthday. He is now cancer-free, and in order to give back, he's hosting his third annual blood drive at his home in Park Ridge on Sunday from noon to 5.
Oh, we got to get here. Let's get Jimmy a Bright Side of Life pin. And
yes, please.
Thank you for promoting that.
You are welcome. I hope as many people who can turn out and donate in droves.
All right, that's Joanne. Thank you, Joanne. One last one from you, or are we all done here?
No, I just logged off. I'm sorry. I thought you were done.
We do this on Fridays. We ask you to call in or text in or share it on Facebook. Producer Griff will take some of you that shared it on Facebook, and we'll award Bright Side of Life pins there, too. It's a whole collection of happy at WGN King John on Facebook.